monastery lecture hall every time there was a Dharma talk. And no one knew who this person was, but he would come. And then after a while, after some period of time, this old man came up to the abbot of the monastery and said, "Well, let me introduce myself. I'm actually a fox. And I 500 lifetimes ago, or generations ago, I was the abbot of this monastery. And a monk came to me and asked me, is an enlightened person free of karma?" And I said, "Yes." And as a consequence of this, I have been reborn as a fox for 500 lives. And so now I've come to you, and I'm going to ask you the same question. Maybe you can set me free from this fate. And is an enlightened person free of karma? And so the current abbot says, an enlightened person does not ignore karma. And then the old man said, "Thank you so much. You freed me. You've enlightened me. In the morning, please take your monks around the backside of the mountain to this big boulder. And behind the boulder, you'll find the corpse of a fox, and that'll be me. And please give this fox the burial suitable for a monk." So the next morning, the abbot took his monks found the body of the fox and brought it back and had a formal ceremony, a burial ceremony like you would have for a monk. And all the monks were very perplexed. Why was the fox getting the special treatment? And then the abbot explained the story that what happened. This is a very important teaching story in Zen, because it's one of the primary ones that a student first has to address, because it has to do with karma and cause and effect, and what is our relationship to the world of karma and causality. And is someone enlightened, are they free of karma? Are they free to do whatever they want and they don't have to worry about the consequences? Or do they have to also be seriously engaged and study the world of karma, the cause and effect, the way their actions, your intentional actions, has an effect in the world? And so, the answer is, of course, you can't ignore it. It's not saying that, he didn't say the enlightened person is subject to karma. It was kind of a little bit vague in between. Enlightened person does not ignore karma, does not overlook it, somehow takes it into account, even though they're free. It takes into account what the consequences of their actions might be. So we have a black cat that wandered in, wandering in completely black, right? It's supposed to be auspicious. He's asking each of us about our karma. No, that's why he came in. There's water up here for it to drink. I think it was meant for me.
I don't know.
You don't know. It was just
here. Obviously, it was meant for me.
So, karma. So I was going to talk about something else today. And I was going to talk about desire. So we can either talk about karma and you can ask questions and prompt me and get me to say something about karma, which might be wonderful now that we've set up the topic. Or I can just venture forth on desire and maybe see if I can bring the two together. What should we do?
Desire.
Well, desire is one of the primary fuels for the karma. So that's good. There's a saying that says something like, love makes the world go round. I don't know the genesis of the saying, whether it's just kind of spontaneously appeared sometime, and people have been saying it ever since. But the Buddhist version of that would not be that love makes the world go round, but rather that some desire makes the world go round. And go round is very nice, because the words for samsara means wandering around and around, the endless cycle of birth and death and rebirth and death again. And desire is the primary fuel for that cycle of endless rebirth, endless conditioned existence. And whether you believe in literal teachings on rebirth and samsara and how exhausting and tiring it is to feel like you're going to be 14 years old again for, you know, 1 million more times. And please, none of that. Which is how the ancient Indians saw the idea of rebirth. I mean, not again. I mean, there's so much suffering in people's lives that, and they saw so much suffering around them that the idea of being reborn was not, you know, so desirable. So whether you believe it literally, like the ancient Indians did, or whether you believe it kind of figuratively, metaphorically, that our minds, our conditioned minds, our mind is conditioned moment by moment. And in its conditioning, it takes in all kinds of different states, and those states are cyclical, they rise and they pass away and they get reborn. And something fuels that process, and one of those things that fuels that is desire. And if you want to be free from this endless cycling and conditionality of the mind, you have to somehow pull out that linchpin of desire from the equation. So desire is what makes the world go round. And of course, love and desire in many people's minds are very hard to distinguish. But that's a very important thing to distinguish. One of the wonderful discoveries in my early kind of college times was discovering the distinction between desire and delight. Or back then I called it the joy of unrequited love. I had discovered that when I fell in love with someone, there was a lot of happiness and joy and a lot of sense of warmth and kind of sense of beauty in the person, appreciation, delight in that person as part of it. And then also, and there was also this kind of, sometimes this desire to want that person, you know, in some kind of way. And at some point, I saw that those two different things. And when I was able to see that they were distinct things, then I was able to love the person or feel delight, appreciation in that person, without automatically having to go into, I want that person in some way. And that has saved me a lot of problems. And I feel has really enriched my life a lot, because I feel much more relaxed now about feeling delight and appreciation and the beauty of other people and a kind of love for people that I encounter. Whereas in my early life, I maybe felt embarrassed by what I was feeling or felt confused about it because the desire was such a big part of it. Desire still might be there at times, but now I see that they're separate. The desire doesn't have to be followed through on. It's desire is actually often not as sublime or as precious as that sense of appreciation, delight, and the other person. So being able to distinguish between desire and delight has been a very important part of my life. As mindfulness practitioners, all of us should become students of desire. It's very important for us to investigate it and get to know it. It has a tremendous number of flavors and types and varieties. And we need to kind of begin sensing and smelling it out in all kinds of different areas of our life, how it works and the costs it has for us, and how we can use it wisely and how we can be free of it so we don't get caught by it. I remember when I was about 20 years old, 21, I was hitchhiking around Europe. I remember it was in Denmark, and I was picked up by a Dane. And that was kind of begun my spiritual interest then, Zen practice and Sufism and all kinds of things that were around back then in the early 70s. And so I was telling him all the things I wanted to do. And I said, you know, I wanted to study Zen, I wanted to go just do Sufism, I wanted to study Aikido and Tai Chi and go to the Gestalt Institute in San Francisco, and I kind of was going through the list, you know, very matter of fact, all the things that I thought I should do, you know. And after a while, this guy listened to me patiently, and he just turned to me and he said, "You have a lot of desires." And that kind of really shook me up a little bit, because I saw immediately kind of the paradox, you know, of this neurotic drive to be free of neurosis. That was kind of a wake-up call for me. It was a little statement of his, you know, "You have a lot of desires," and how maybe I was going in the wrong direction by trying to fill up my time, my life, with trying to do too many things and all these wonderful things. In a sense, we have kind of a cornucopia of worthwhile things to pursue in our society. So it's very hard, and because they all seem worthwhile, then of course we should just follow through with them all. But any wise living in our society is going to require us to kind of prioritize what it is we really want to do, what's really important for us, so we can really do some things well and really benefit from it, and learn how to let go of a lot of things which are actually quite worthwhile. The other kind of story of my own life I was thinking of today was, I used to read a lot of books, and now I just collect them. But I used to read a lot, and I used to love to go into bookstores. But I started noticing at some point that I leave the bookstores completely fried, frazzled, like exhausted. And after a while in studying that, what I discovered was that bookstores were, I would have desire explosions in bookstores. I would just want so many different books, just wanting, and I didn't even know sometimes what I wanted. I just knew that I wanted. And so, I mean, it's one thing to see something that's wonderful and wanted, right? But to go into a bookstore and say, "I don't care, I just want, let's find something that fills that need." And so I'd be in there, this wanting machine, walking around, you know, and seeing all these titles and covers, and you know, sometimes I wouldn't buy anything, but still I would leave kind of exhausted. And now I can, there also was very important for me to distinguish between desire and delight, because once I was able to distinguish that around books too, not just people, now I can go to a bookstore and not even plan to buy anything, and just have a delight just walking around. It doesn't really matter if I don't even try to see the whole bookstore like I used to. You know, just I go find maybe one table or one shelf, and that's good enough for now. Or I'll find one book, you know, while my wife is doing something, and I'll just look at that book for a while until she says, "Come on." So much more relaxed. There are times in my life where desire has been kind of the main operating mode of mine. Times it seems like I'm the desire type. So I've had to kind of study my desire and get to know it well. And there's all kinds of desires to be had. But the most interesting one, I think, is the one where you don't even know what you want, and you just want. And I see it very much with my son, 3.5-year-old, earlier, I remember. It's very obvious to me that he wants before he knows what he wants. There are times. Like, for example, he'll, with great passion, say, "Daddy, I want to ask you a question." And then I say, "Okay, what is it?" Only. And then he has to think about it, because he hadn't thought about it before. He just, you know, he has this desire to ask a question in the abstract, you know, and then he has to fill that desire with something concrete. And sometimes he'll say, "Oh, I can't think of anything now." And then, or, you know, the classic thing was when he was younger, was I was holding him, and he didn't know what was behind him, but he went like this to grab it. And, you know, obvious, he didn't know, just desire was functioning just empty of content, just desire by itself. And maybe someone who's a good psychologist who really understands child development understands the desire, but it seems to me like desire, I mean, my son is there before he knows what he wants, just desire. And I've seen that in myself, that I can have just desire can be functioning kind of an automatic pilot, and I'm just looking for things to fill that, you know, it's like a blank check, you know, it's a blank desire, just I'll fill it with something. And where it's most painful to see is when the mind is chasing after desires, one after the other, like if a person gets really busy, for example, and the mind will have kind of a momentum of wanting. It's kind of a habit formation. And that momentum, even though you've fulfilled your wanting, the wanting momentum is still there. And then it just wants to latch on to more and more things. Something else to fill it. And sometimes when this power of momentum, the habit formation is really strong, it actually is not satisfying to fulfill the desire. Because as soon as the desire is fulfilled, sometimes we're just propelled to have something else. The sad thing about functioning totally on desire, always thinking, wanting, is that we're always then looking ahead into the future. It could be in the future 1 second, could be a year or whatever, but we're never then at rest and settled in the present moment. And it's a tremendous cost to sacrifice being at rest, being settled in the present moment. There's a tremendous cost to be driven by desire. There can be all kinds of stupid mistakes we make. I've certainly made my stupid mistakes in desire when my guard was off. I remember once when in my early, I was spending a night in a woman's apartment, and I was going to sleep on the couch, right? That was the plan. And before it was time to go, you know, say goodnight or whatever, she came and sat on the couch with me and put her hands on my lap and said how glad she was I was there. And it was obvious that I was being invited to her bed. But this was an inappropriate woman for me to be involved in. It was pretty clear to me that this was not right. I think I was committed somewhere else, going steady or something. And I just ignored it and lay down on the couch to go to sleep. She went to her room and, you know, creatively left the door open. So I didn't sleep that night. I tossed and turned, and I should have been a lawyer, because every possible justification and rationale for why I should go into that open door came up to my mind, and it was just tremendous struggle. It was really kind of, I thought these things only existed in myth. You know, these kind of great struggles with oneself and with desire, and you know, I didn't break out in a sweat exactly, but it was like a wild night, just by myself. And then in the middle of the night, she came out to get water. And then she came over to kind of say hello. So I held off. I managed. I was really proud of myself. I held off. I managed to until dawn. Dawn came. It's like, phew, I made it. And I let down my guard. I said, well, it's okay now to go into that bedroom. And somehow I just drifted in there, and the rest was, you can use your imagination. So the desires can be so powerful, and we shouldn't underestimate the power of it, that they can really get the better of us at times and take over our wise judgments. How many of you, probably you don't want to raise your hand, right? But how many of you in the last 2 or 3 years invested in the stock market and now look back and say, well, you know, I think I was operating on desire that maybe was not such a wise thing, but that was really desire. But when you made the investment, it didn't seem like desire. It seemed like, you know, everyone else is doing it, it might as well. But desire causes a lot. You know, there's a whole power that often gets us not to think very clearly, and also doesn't get us to see life very clearly. You can see other people very clearly. One of the sad things, of course, about sexual desire, when it's operating very powerfully, is you don't really see the other person at times. The person becomes the object of the sexual desire, and the humanity of the person is not really seen. The wonderful thing about being able to distinguish delight from desire is then you can maybe really see the person much more clearly, and at least you're not as blinded by what desire is causing you to see. Buddhism does not problematize all desire, which some people think is the problem. Just most desire. It problematizes that desire which is driven, which is compulsive, which has a kind of compulsive quality to it, where we kind of feel driven to follow through on it and act on it. Because when we're driven and when there's compulsion going on, then we're not free to choose wisely what to do and to see clearly what's going on. There can be wise desire, desire to do all kinds of things that are worthwhile doing in life and desire having. But neurotic desire has this quality of craving or greed that's part of it. I recently translated the Dhammapada, which is a very ancient, long poem, Buddhist poem, the earliest Buddhist texts. And one of the things that struck me in reading this, in translating this book, was how many different words the book has for desire, for greed, for clinging, for attachment. I couldn't find enough English words to match all the different Pali words. So I just used, clinging over and over and over again for different words. But maybe it's like the Eskimos have all the words of snow. The Buddhists have all these words for nuances of clinging and compulsion and drivenness and thirst and addiction. We have a lot, I guess. But without taking an interest in how desire functions in our life, what it looks like, how we act on it, how we justify it, the rationale we have for it, what the consequences of it, unless we study these things and find out for ourselves what it's actually like, don't read a book about it and get it as a good, some good ideas, but really, be our own laboratory for studying it, we're not going to become wise about desire. And this talk today is really, I'm really trying to encourage you to turn that lens of attention back towards yourself and see if you can just learn something new about the desire that you've never noticed before. In the process of doing that, not be driven by compulsion, to be wise. There are a number of ways of working with desire when it arises. One of the very best ways when you have the opportunity to study desire is in meditation. Meditation is one of the preeminently fantastic places to have emotions. First of all, when you're sitting in meditation, you're given permission to have whatever emotional desire, intention, or motivation that's going on inside of you. Complete, unconditional permission to have whatever's occurring inside of you. There's no religious message in Buddhism that says, thou shalt not be angry or desirous or any kind of way. You don't have to censor yourself or feel bad or judgmental or guilty. Isn't it a relief to know there's such a place that you can just go and sit and meditate? It's like going into this wonderful sacred refuge where kids have, what do they call it when you go play tag and you have a place that's not time out, but...
Base.
Are you safe?
Base.
Base, you're safe in base? Okay. So meditation is like base. And so you have this place where you can just come and just, it's okay, whatever's going on. So if you're lucky enough to have a good desire when you're meditating, it's really good. Because then you get to study it. And so you say, okay, what is this desire like? I don't have to push it away. I'm not going to act on it, because I can't, because I'm just sitting here. Unless it's, sometimes you can act in fantasy, but I'm not going to act on it. I'm just going to really feel and sense and be present for this thing called anger. One of the things is very simple, is to feel what it's like in the body. And if it's really powerful, the desire, then you kind of sometimes feel like, you can't sit still. It's like the rodeo. And sometimes you feel hot, and sometimes you feel all kinds of different sensations in the body. Sometimes the body will lean forward, will tighten up and get contracted. Sometimes the body, all kinds of things the muscles do in the body, sometimes very subtle. Different movements of energy or heat in the body, depending on what kind of, desire it might be. But to get a taste and feel what it's like in the body, because if you can get a really good sense of the bodily experience of desire, a lot of the compulsion around desire has to do with what arises out of the body sensations. And if you can really get to know what the body sensations of desire is like, then you're less likely to be tricked or compelled by those very sensations when they arise. So you can just surf on them, hang out with them. Surfing is a great thing to do with our emotions. The other thing we can do with desire when it arises is to start studying what our relationship to that desire is. How do we relate to it? Do we always believe every desire that we have? Some people kind of think that it's my desire. I mean, they've never been told that there's desires are, you know. My son, you know, I don't know. I wonder if he's getting a lesson that what he's learning from us about desire. Sorry. Some of us believe our desires. You know, they say it's my desire after all. Or we have various attitudes about desire when it arises that are not the desire itself, but our attitudes about it. For example, I deserve it, or I don't deserve it. I'm unworthy of that kind of desire. Not me, I shouldn't have that. Or, yes, of course, everyone deserves that. Many years ago, I went to drive a new car with a car salesperson. And the salesman said, I was driving around and he was asking me what kind of things I wanted in my car. And I didn't want hardly anything in the car, right? And which wasn't very good for him. And so finally he's trying to talk me into an air conditioner. And he had a great pitch because he didn't know I was Buddhist, but he said, you know, everything changes. So I said, oh. So I woke me up a little bit. Where's this going to go? Well, the conclusion that everything changes is you deserve an air conditioner. That's where he was going with it. So there's all kinds of, and sometimes there's tremendous rationale, philosophies, political positions people have that really support one person's individual desire. A desire to have a gun can be as simple as, you know, all kinds of things. I remember a friend of mine who found a gun in the park one day and took it home, took the bullets out, and kept it in a locked box in the garage until one day he was mugged out nearby. And then he remembered the gun when he got it. And when running around with his blank gun with a bag of bullets in his hand, and ran into the projects in San Francisco. And, I mean, what a scene. This guy had a shaved head, shaved Aryan kind of guy. He was a Zen person, but he was of Nordic stock. Shaved head, running into African-American projects in San Francisco with a gun in his hand and a little brown bag in his other hand. So, of course the police arrested him. And anyway, he found this gun in the park. And so he had to explain how he got this gun. And he said, it was because of, it was a power object. He liked having a power object. I thought that was kind of an honest statement. But I could well imagine someone then fueling that desire for a gun, the power object, with all this, Second Amendment stuff. You know, and all kinds of whole political position, political stuff. So what's the attitude we have towards our desire is a very important question. Some people are excessively generous to their desires, so much so that we're slaves to it, and some people are excessively afraid of their desires, so much they're also a slave of it in a sense, but they just resist it and feel like every desire is wrong and bad to have. To start seeing what the relationship we have to it is a very important part of the cognitive part, the thought, the ideas, and also to study our beliefs about what we think the desire will do for us. Because often desire is tied into what we believe it'll do for us. And I've known people who've, you know, thought that particular relationship, that's going to do it for me. When I marry her or him, then everything will be taken care of. And then 10 years after the marriage, you say, you know, it didn't work out that way at all. you know, I'm actually still left with myself and left with all these feelings that I have and these yearnings and feeling of aloneness. And so we often put a lot of credence and belief into what the desires will do for us. That's more than just the simplicity of fulfilling the desire itself. It's going to provide us with security and happiness and lasting happiness and power or whatever. So looking at the belief systems and then questioning them, are our beliefs warranted? This requires not only mindfulness, but it requires a certain degree of reflection and thinking about what mindfulness reveals to us. An important part of a spiritual life is a certain amount of reflection of what's going on. Maybe not in meditation itself, but you want to be able to grapple with your belief system, not just see them and continue merrily as you wish. It's also possible to look at the cost of your desires. What's the consequences of having a desire, of acting on it? And you can fill in that for yourself. Sometimes the fulfilled desire, acting on it, is very different than the cost of simply having the desire. Just the sense of the terrible sense sometimes of being driven and compulsed and tight and constricted and blinded and by desire, even if you can't follow through on it, has a tremendous cost. Or the cost of being frustrated. Frustrated desire is a part of everyone's life. What do you do when you have a desire and it can't be fulfilled? What is the ways in which you react to that? Do you get angry and upset? Do you get tense? Do you get angry at the world? Or do you relax? I wanted to find the story and I couldn't. But it goes very vaguely like this. It has to do with St. Francis. And St. Francis apparently asked his fellow monks, brothers, what gave them the most joy? And if any of you know the story, please tell me, you know, about it so I can get it right. But and so they went through, and each of them had a different thing to say. And he basically, I don't know if he denied each one as being it, but it's kind of like it was one-upmanship. And so finally it was St. Francis' turn to say what gave him the greatest joy. And he said something like this: when I'm really destitute, when I'm starving, cold, I don't have any clothes on, I'm out in the snow, and the snow in the middle of Italy in wintertime, but anyway, it's cold, it certainly gets cold, and I'm hungry, and I have no place to sleep, and it's a stormy winter night, and I go and knock on someone's door to ask for a little bit of bread or for some refuge, and I open the door, and the person just vilifies me and laughs at me and throws me out into the gutters. That's the greatest joy. So how do you understand that? And how I understand that is that, and this is my interpretation of the story, is that St. Francis was someone who knew that how to let go. He knew how to rest in emptiness, or how to rest in the presence of God, or and rest in a certain presence of being that doesn't require anything at all. Doesn't need to require the fulfillment of any desire at all. And when his little simple desire for bread was frustrated by this very sharp rebuke, rather than getting angry himself or upset or depressed, it was an opportunity for him to let go thoroughly. And the more down and out, the more desperate the situation was, the more it allowed him to let go thoroughly enough, which is a doorway to joy, at least for him. So that's a dramatic example. But what do you do when you come down Sandhill at 9 o'clock in the morning and they're doing road work? And everyone's trying to get to work. And suddenly it's backed up all the way back to 280. That's a frustrated desire there. How do you relate to that? Isn't it an opportunity to let go at that moment and find the presence of peace, the presence of emptiness, the presence of God, if that's what your tradition is, or, you know, is it an opportunity to discover what is always here a kind of joy and a peace which is completely independent of your desire to get down that road quickly? Or do you take that as an opportunity to get steamed up and frustrated and angry and depressed? If you look at the cost of that, you're stuck there in Sand Hill anyway. You're not going to go any faster because you're steaming. What's the value of letting our frustrated desire get the upper hand when you can't do anything about it anyway? How many times in our life is our frustrated desire lead to suffering that maybe is unnecessary? So Saint Francis was a remarkable person. But apparently because of that, he had remarkable joy. Ajahn Chah said, if you let go of a little bit, you have a little peace. If you let go a moderate amount, you'll have a moderate amount of peace. And if you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of peace. I don't have a watch. Thank you. Oh, I have 35 seconds to conclude this. Yes.
Yeah, I got a question about the metaphysical aspect of desire. And I know if you, like in your stories, if you let go, you really let go, you can get joy and all that. My experience and experience seems to be of most other people is when you really, really let, you have a desire for something, really, really let go, totally let go, what I found is what you're desiring shows up. And it's a place of real power. And of course, then I find myself getting into a game of, well, I really want something, so I'll let go. And Ram Dass talked about this phenomenon in the book, Be Here Now, the whole paradox. And if you can really have it all once you let go of it all. So, give me comments on that.
Well, I don't subscribe to the belief of that in some superstitious or metaphysical way. You use the word metaphysical. I think to a certain degree it's kind of very obvious what can happen. So, for example, if you're always needy in a relationship, you always want the perfect mate, and you're always looking, grabbing and wanting and desperate, you know, and I mean, people just go like this, you know, please leave me alone, you know, no one wants to get close to you. But then if you really relax and you kind of don't need anybody, you're at peace with yourself and enjoy, people are attracted to you because everyone wants to be around someone who's happy in themselves. And so suddenly you find people around you all the time. And so the thing you wanted comes your way, but it's not odd, it's not a strange thing, it's just that's kind of what...
Yeah, I'm thinking also of not so much relationships, that too somewhat, but objects and things just seem to, or situations seem to just fall into place when you just totally let go. It seems to be a place of complete power if you can, when one can do that.
Yeah, it seems that things work that way often. I don't know what to say in reply. I'm just comfortable with saying that there seems to be a tendency at times for a vacuum to get filled. And people tend to be a lot more generous around people who are at peace and free than people who are kind of always being compulsive and all that. And so it's happened to me plenty of times that I made a decision, some kind of decision in my life to follow the Dharma that didn't seem to be financially wise. Like when I went to Japan to practice in Japan, I had something like, I don't know, I had very little money, maybe $200 or so for the year. So I thought, well, I'll get a job. But after I kind of signed up for this job, I decided that what I was really there was to practice the Dharma, and I don't want to do some like this job thing. So come what may, I'm just going to throw myself into the Dharma and see what happens and just trust. And I left Japan with more money than I came with. It was maybe $250 rather than $200. But you know exactly. I'm uncomfortable with making it a metaphysical principle out of it. Also, I'm a little bit suspicious of people then who rely on that metaphysical principle in the way that you kind of pointed to, because really it's just a more subterranean way of, you know, skillful, you know, way of kind of getting what they want. Just, if I'm just really good and spiritual, you know, then, so they're kind of like, I'll just be that way. And, but really, it's not that way at all. Yeah.
Seems to me that if you truly let go of it, and it comes to you, then you don't want it anymore, and you don't take it.
I think so. Yes?
What do you teach your son about desire? Because I have a daughter who says, Mom, I just want something, and I just don't know what it is.
Oh.
She can talk now, so she'll say that, and it's, I don't know how to reply.
I don't know. The I know sometimes my son has said, I don't want that. I don't want to do that. Like, and I say, that's fine. You don't have to want to in order to do it. So, well, some one of the things, my tendency would be in a statement like that, is to listen or prompt or questions or something, and see if there's something deeper going on, because I would operate a little bit of an assumption. Maybe a young child who says, "I want something, I don't know what it is," maybe it does have a need, and then you have to find out what is that need, and it might not. They also might have maladaptive ways of filling that need. Maybe what they want is some security at that moment. They want to be held, and or you know, so. But the reason I started talking about my son earlier, I got sidetracked by myself, was it seemed to start very early. One of the teachings in Buddhism is that samsara, or desire, has no beginning. So it isn't that you need to analyze to find what the original childhood source of your desire is. Sometimes there are childhood sources of your particular thing or whatever. But ultimately, at the root, our desires don't necessarily have to have a first cause. They're just there. So we're kind of born with them. And so it's a matter of learning how to be wise with them and how to be free of them, not necessarily how to be free of them, free of them in a sense of not being caught by them, not free from them in a sense of being without them. I was just getting warmed up today. This was the introduction to desire. So, but anyway, the whole point of this talk was really to encourage each of you to find out what's true for you about desire and study it. And perhaps next time I come on a Monday, I think at the end of July, if maybe we can continue desire. So have a wonderful July, 4th of July, Independence Day, and you know, it's possible to enjoy your desires and not act on them. It's also possible to be miserable. So, thank you.